Okay, is that better? All right. The problem is I can't wave both hands, and for somebody of Italian heritage, it's very hard not to wave both hands. All right, so they were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they walked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him. Yes, there it is. Good. So these were two of Jesus' disciples. Clearly they knew him well. We can safely assume that they had seen Jesus in action, preaching words of hope and salvation, feeding the hungry, performing miracles such as healing and resurrecting life out of death, and offering unconditional love to all, but especially the marginalized, the misfits, the outcasts of society, those who had no status, no hope, and felt unloved. And talking about status, I just want to make the observation about the disciples with whom we are walking. Cleopas and the other disciple, whose name we don't actually know, they're not, if I can call them, members of the A team. They're not members of the first grade of Jesus' disciples. We're not talking here about Luke or John or Matthew. We're not talking here about Peter. We're talking about an event that happens on what we call Easter Sunday, involving two relatively unknown disciples. And I think that's really special, because the disciples in question were just like us. So they had no status. But these disciples had come to love him. If they were like the other more well-known disciples of which we read in the Gospels, and they probably were like them in some ways, they had probably given up many things and made lots of sacrifices in order to follow Jesus. Now, in verse 16 it says, but they were kept from recognizing him. Now, why? Why were they kept from recognizing him? And to personalize it, to bring it down to our level, why is it that God does that to us sometimes? That is to say, not allow us to see the big picture, or to be conscious of his presence, or that he is in fact in the very situations that you and I are in on a daily basis. That he is in fact at work to bring about his purposes. Why is it that we are kept from understanding that? Why is it that we don't see that? Now, it's interesting, the Apostle Paul speaks about this in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. This is a verse you probably remember, for he says, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face, for now in part, now I know in part, and then I shall know fully. It's kind of God's way of working, and it's God's right to do it. But isn't it reassuring to know that God is there with you, wherever you go, whatever you do, in whatever situation you are in? God is here with us even now, right now. And it is so often only in hindsight, when we are looking back, that we can see clearly that God was there, that God was at work, that God was protecting, that God was sustaining, that God was giving strength, wisdom, love to deal with the situations that we are in. Now, Jesus was walking with Cleopas and his mate. That is a fact. Whether they knew that at the time, whether they appreciated that, doesn't change the reality one little bit. And you see, that applies to you and I today. We pick it up from verse 17. He asked them, remember the person asking is Jesus, but they don't know, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened in these days?" They stood still, their faces downcast. Now, I told you before about Luke being a historian. He's interested in facts. He's interested in detail. What an interesting piece of detail. They stood still, their faces downcast. They stopped dead in their tracks. Now, what had been up until then a purposeful journey from Jerusalem to Emmaus suddenly stopped. They stood still. Now, we don't know if they were walking along a busy road. We don't know if it in fact was a highway between Jerusalem and Emmaus. We don't know how busy it was, but you can imagine in your mind if it was a busy road and all of a sudden the person in front of you just stops dead in their tracks, it'd be annoying. Imagine this happening at Miranda Fair over Christmas during the sales. You know what it's like? People everywhere. And all of a sudden, the people in front of you stop suddenly, dead in their tracks. If it was like that, I bet you it's understandable, isn't it, that if you were walking behind them, you might be annoyed, you might be frustrated, you might even be angry with them. At least, I hope, until you glanced up at the faces of these people who are slowing you down, getting in your way, and you notice their sad and downcast faces. And then perhaps a trace of empathy and compassion starts to cloud the feelings of annoyance, frustration, and anger. Now, when was the last time you stopped dead in your tracks, stood still, and felt downcast? Maybe there was that intense feeling of sadness. Maybe there was that feeling like you had been punched in the guts. Maybe a feeling of hurt, of disappointment, of betrayal, of surprise. And so often in those situations I've found, and maybe you have as well, that the question that lurks at the back of your mind is, where are you, God? What are you doing? Now, last Sunday, Pastor Dave was sharing from John chapter 20, verses 19 to 29, and he spoke of the experiences of the disciples who felt that they had been stood up by Jesus. Cleopas and his mate were wrecked not just by feelings of confusion, disappointment, and doubt, but were experiencing the profound grief of losing a dear friend and mentor who, in sharing his life with them, had renewed and transformed them and showed them a way of experiencing God that transcended anything that they had learnt at the synagogue or through the Old Testament Bible. Whether or not Jesus was in fact the Messiah, a fact that of course was only proved beyond a shadow of doubt by the resurrection, of which these two did not know, to them, Jesus was still the most extraordinary man they had ever met. And these disciples considered him a friend who was gone, they thought. Is it any wonder that they stood still, their faces downcast? Verse 19, we pick it up from there. So Jesus asks, what things, he asks. And they said, about Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and all our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see Jesus. And he said to them, now he is Jesus, how foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets had spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Now, I've got a confession to make. When I first read verse 25, you know, how foolish you are. My instant reaction was to think that Jesus had lapsed into some uncharacteristic unfairness and criticism of these two disciples. I thought, Jesus, you're a little bit over the top here. It's a bit rough calling these two fools, given what they've been through in following you and given the grief that they're experiencing because they think you're dead. But the more I sat with this, the more I came to realize that, in fact, that wasn't right. Now, for example, Jesus didn't actually call Cleopas and his companion fools. In fact, he was referring to their behavior as being foolish, and specifically their slowness to, in effect, join the dots between what he had been teaching about himself and his purpose and the events that actually occurred in fulfillment of the teaching. In fact, this is just a gentle reprimand. And when you look a little bit earlier in Luke 24, in that same chapter, it's actually the second reprimand. Because if we go back to verse 5, and this is Luke's account of the women at the tomb of Jesus. Now, you remember that they found that the stone had been rolled away, and the body of the Lord Jesus couldn't be found. And then suddenly there were two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning, stood beside them and uttered this gentle reprimand. Why do you look for the living among the dead? Another gentle reprimand. And you see, sometimes God does that with us too. He gives us a gentle reprimand. Now, with me, I can imagine in my mind God's holy finger prodding me on my chest or my shoulder and saying to me, mate — he never calls me Tom, by the way, it's always mate, but it's always a gentle prod. It's enough to get my attention. It's enough to perhaps make me feel uncomfortable, but it never hurts. Now, for you Monty Python fans out there — are there Monty Python fans out there? Yes, there's a few, thank you. It's not like the finger of God from Monty Python's Meaning of Life, where there's this sudden clap of thunder and the giant finger — remember the scene — comes down from the sky and obliterates It's not like Monty Python's finger of God, okay? It's a gentle prod on the chest or the shoulder with God saying, mate, what are you doing? Mate, what are you thinking? Is this just me, or perhaps this has happened to you? Have there been times, perhaps, times when, perhaps like the women at the tomb, or perhaps like Cleopas and his friend on the road to Emmaus, you too are wondering, God, where are you? I've been praying for so long, but getting no answers. I'm really hurting, God, can't you feel it? I've been serving you so faithfully, God, and for so long, and getting nowhere. Why did this person who I love have to die? Why would you allow that? Why? And maybe God is saying to you what he says to me. Mate, I love you so much that I sacrificed my own son, Jesus, for you. You can't see the whole picture. I can. Nothing can separate you from my love. That's all you need to know for now. Just get on with your life, living your life for me, and I'll give you the power through the Holy Spirit to get by day. Perhaps we should all long for, we should yearn for God's gentle prod on our chest or shoulder, where God asks you, mate, what are you doing? Oh, to have such undivided attention of God, such intimacy, that he would say to you and I personally, how foolish you are. If I were Cleopas or his companion, I would never, ever forget what Jesus said to me, how foolish you are. Verse 28, as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going farther. But they urged him strongly, stay with us, for it is nearly evening, the day is almost over. So he went in to stay with them. I want to suggest to you, these are two verses that a typical detail from Luke, that when you think about it, it is profound. It was I'm convinced, a pivotal moment in the life of Cleopas and his friend. In fact, possibly a pivotal moment in all of Luke's gospel. Now, we've had many pivotal moments in history. Let's just think about the lifetime of some of the senior citizens in our community. My mother-in-law, Dorothy, is with us today. So let's look at, say, 90 years. Let's think about the defining pivotal events of the last 90 years, the Great Depression, the Second World War, the nuclear age, women's rights, and these are just a few. Let's think about pivotal moments and where you have been when they occurred. Some of us actually remember watching Neil Armstrong walk on the moon, live, extraordinary. The Berlin Wall fall. For each one of us, there are personal, individual, pivotal moments in life. For example, for me, when I came to know Jesus personally in 1979, my wedding, the birth of my two sons, and being in New York on September 11, 2001. Perhaps one of the greatest under-recognized pivotal moments in New Testament history occurs in these two verses, and maybe we haven't noticed it before. So these two disciples of Jesus are about to reach their destination at Emmaus, and they've had this probably incredibly intense, certainly fascinating and life-changing conversation with a man who they still do not recognize to be Jesus. And the three of them are approaching the village of Emmaus, and Jesus gives every indication to Cleopas and his mate that whilst Emmaus might be their destination, it's not necessarily his destination, so he's going to verse on. He's going to walk on. But verse 29 says, "But they urged him strongly, stay with us." Now, Luke doesn't muck around with words. He chooses his words very carefully. Note the strong language here. They didn't just urge him, they urged him strongly. Now, urge means to try earnestly or persistently to persuade someone to do something. Luke didn't need to add the word strongly because the stock standard meaning of urge already conveys that. But Luke makes the point of saying that these two urged him strongly. We get the word urgent from urge. It was urgent for Cleopas and his mate that this man with whom they have walked along the road to Emmaus would stay and eat at the table with them and share their hospitality. Now, we're now in week 10 of this amazing series of messages from Luke's gospel that are united by the theme at the table, where we have been reminded again and again how important hospitality was to Jesus and how it was used in ministry. And here we see how for Cleopas and his mate, it was not just important, it was urgent. It was strongly urgent that they invite this stranger to sit at the table with them. And I just wonder sometimes whether we share that sense of urgency. Oh, would that we shared that sense of urgency. And then just imagine for a moment in your minds if they hadn't invited Jesus in for dinner. Imagine that enormous gap in their life. Then we go to verse 30. He was at the table with them. He took bread. He gave thanks. He broke it again and began to give it to them. And then their eyes opened and they recognized him and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? So verse 31 tells us that their eyes were opened and they recognized him at the point when Jesus broke the bread and gave it to them. And for them, it must have been like going from complete blindness to having just perfect vision. The opening of their eyes was a God act. It was a divine act. But it's interesting to read some of the commentaries who speculate about this. Now, the most common theory I can tell you is that as disciples of Jesus, they had seen him break bread before. It was a familiar act, and it was that act that enabled them to join the dots, so to speak, and recognize that their traveling companion was, in fact, their own Jesus. But another interesting theory, this is interesting, I wouldn't put too much credence on this, is that it wasn't until Jesus was breaking the bread that they noticed the nail wounds in his hands. And that was the point of recognition. Look, in any event, at the point of recognition, Jesus disappears. And then we get verse 32, one of my just all-time favorite verses of the Bible, and we close on this. Were not our hearts burning within us while He talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us. Now, what does this verse mean to us? What does it mean for our hearts to burn in the context of our Christian lives? Now, the first thing to notice is that the hearts of these two disciples were burning even before they discovered they had been walking with the risen Jesus. Because they're, you know, when they're talking in verse 32, they're talking about their hearts burning before, as they're walking along the road. So we might infer that God starts doing a work within us, a holy work, a Jesus work, preparing us to meet Jesus personally before that actually happens. And I wonder, by the way, whether hospitality is where some of the God preparation actually takes place. And the second thing to notice is what these two disciples were doing when their hearts were burning. They were walking along the road with Jesus and listening whilst he opened the scriptures to them. There was a doing and there was a listening. God's word, the scriptures, played an important role, no doubt. But there was a doing and there was a listening. And that's what happens at the table in any form of hospitality. There's a doing, there's an eating, there's a drinking, there's a talking, and there's a listening. And God could be doing a work of preparation there. I was really intrigued with this concept of hearts burning, conscious of the fact that Luke chooses his words very carefully. So I went digging in the scriptures and discovered that in the Old Testament there are two similar examples that might give us a deeper understanding of what it means. For example, in Psalm 39, and there's no need to look for this now, but we encounter a deeply, deeply troubled King David who is suffering illness, which he understands to be God rebuking him for his wrongdoing. And David writes about this in his anguish, and then in verse 3 he says, "My heart grew hot within me, and as I meditated, the fire burned." In Jeremiah chapter 20, we encounter the prophet Jeremiah, who's literally in stocks. And in stocks, remember what stocks are? So his head, his hands and feet were restrained by a wooden device that was designed not just to give pain, but in fact worse, to inflict public humiliation. And he's being persecuted, you see, and punished for preaching the prophetic message of God that God has placed on his heart. And he's under enormous pressure to stop his preaching. And in verse 9, Jeremiah says this, "But if I say, I will not mention him or speak any more in his name, his word is in my heart like a fire shut up in my bones. I am weary of holding it in. Indeed, I cannot." So two powerful examples from the Old Testament of hearts burning. So these two passages have in common two faithful servants of God who are at deep crises in their lives. Illness for David, persecution and humiliation for Jeremiah. And yet in their adversity, they are in the pits. Their hearts burned for God and to do his work. For Cleopas and his mate, it's not at the point of crisis, but rather at the point of elation in their lives that they experience their hearts burning. So what does it mean for us to have hearts burning in the context of a Christian lives, in the context of our daily relationship with Jesus? It is a deep compulsion within us which is hard to contain or suppress. It is a feeling that cannot be smothered but keeps bursting forth, kind of like this sort of explosion. It's a tremendous feeling, something almost beyond endurance. It's a strange elation, a strange elation. And it has an impact and it is potentially transformative. And I think having a burning heart affects God's people in different ways. We see immediately how it impacted on these disciples. They picked themselves up straight away and they walked back to Jerusalem. So they've walked 7 miles. They're having this meal with Jesus and they go straight back They found the 11 disciples and told them of their remarkable experience of walking with Jesus and how their hearts burned. They witnessed to the fact of the resurrected Christ and, in effect, how the resurrected Christ had resurrected them from sadness to joy, from despair into elation. Oh, to have a heart that burns for Jesus. To have that heart for burns that burns for Jesus and to take it with us wherever we go, whether we're in church or not. A heart that is hospitable, a heart that is welcoming, a heart that is accepting, a heart that is boldly dependent on God's own power through his Holy Spirit. I'm going to ask Grant and Andrew to come on up and we're going to share in communion together. And if you've got a faith with Jesus, come and join us. We're going to take some bread and we're going to remember that God loved us so much that he gave us his only son, Jesus, to die for us that we might have a life that is full, that is abundant, that is eternal. We're going to take a cup of juice to remember that Jesus' blood was shed on the cross for us and presents us holy and acceptable in God's sight. Now come forward now. Come and eat and drink in your own time. You can take it back to your seat if you like, or you can stand around and eat it together. But as you come forward, as you come and eat and drink, and as you personally give thanks for this bread and cup, I want you to think also about the state of your heart. Does it burn now? Did it once burn, but the flame has gone out? Do something about it today. Did your heart once burn strongly, but is now just a flickering ember? Do something about that today to restore it to where it was. And maybe your heart has never burned for Jesus, but you want it to. Do something about that today. Talk to someone. Ponder these things as we remember what God has done for us through Jesus on the cross, and how our resurrected King has resurrected us, and how our resurrected King can resurrect our hearts too. Come and share around this table.